From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Berlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. I'll talk with Joshua Landis about three stories he's following in the Middle East. Inspectors in Syria have found traces of banned chemical weapons, new opportunities for France as the U.S. relationship with the region becomes strained, and the Vatican's recognition of the Palestinian state.
Israel made an announcement that this is not helpful to peace, that it's going to spoil the Palestinians, and that they won't come to the table. But it's also the price that Netanyahu is going to pay if he doesn't want to have peace talks.
Then I'll talk with Kate Schechter. She's the CEO of the Oklahoma City-based NGO World Neighbors. Her interest in internationalism started when she was a child, growing up in places like Hong Kong and Moscow.
We're the first American children to go to Soviet school. And I learned Russian very quickly.
All that is coming up right after this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlat. Joshua Landis, let's do all things Middle East this week, now that you're here with us in the studio. Let's start with Syria. So recently, there were traces of chemical weapons found at their military bases there, several of them, sarin and ricin, found by inspectors there. Now, the question is this a violation of the 2013 deal to remove those chemical weapons? Is this evidence that they're retaining stockpiles? I mean, I don't think there's any evidence that they're being used, but what's going on here?
Well, it's a very good question. United States claimed to have destroyed 95% of Syria's chemical weapons. This was after August 2013 blow-up in which Russia and President Obama agreed and with Syria that they would take out all these weapons. Now, many people accused him of holding them back. Syria today is at a turning point because the rebels have made some dramatic gains, and there's a big push on by the rebel community to try to get America to step in and set up a no-fly zone and to help dispatch Assad. Turkey, Saudi Arabia have come up with a new agreement on Syria, and they want America on their side. That's one of the things that the Saudis are doing and the other Gulf Arabs were hoping to do in Washington just recently when they met at Camp David. So this is high-pitched right now. Everybody is using this chemical weapons situation to try to sway America to destroy Assad and side with the Saudis and the rebels and the Turks.
Well, is this likely to work? And what about the impact that this has? I mean, does Assad lose any credibility here? Are more people maybe going to jump on that bandwagon of let's get rid of Assad? Is this helping him in any way?
He's in a weakened position. And I don't think America is going to jump into the Saudi-Turkish side because they're worried that if Assad loses, if there are chemical weapons, the rebels are going to take them. And at the heart of the main rebel push is al-Qaeda. So Turkey, in a sense, Saudi Arabia, are empowering al-Qaeda now because they want Assad out of Damascus. And al-Qaeda is part of a coalition of militias, Islamist militias, that are very effective. So this puts America in a very difficult position. You want them out, but you don't want them out because you're worried that the other guys are going to be even worse. So that's the American dilemma, and that's what America faces with Saudi Arabia and the Gulf because they're pushing America. You've got to be on our side.
Well, let's go to the Gulf since you've mentioned them a couple times now. So we've had some recent discussions. Obviously, countries like Saudi Arabia are upset with the United States. There are these tense relations we've talked about in recent weeks, particularly over the differences they have over the nuclear deal with Iran. So where are we today in terms of our relations with Saudi Arabia? Saudi is a very close partner of the United States, but is clearly troubled by this engagement with Iran. But at the same time, why is it that Saudi Arabia would want Iran to have nuclear weapons either? So help us understand the bottom line here.
America is transitioning in its policy towards the Middle East. We traditionally were extremely pro-Saudi and pro-Sunni. We were against Hezbollah, Shiite group in Lebanon. We were against Assad, Shiite dominant group in Syria. We were against Iran and had brutal sanctions on Iran. So for the last few decades, we've been helping the Sunnis against the Shiites. Today, that situation is changing. Because Iran has helped, we're worried today about ISIS, a Sunni power, al-Qaeda, a Sunni group. It's mostly Sunni terrorism that we're worried about today. And that means that we're working with Iran in Iraq to try to destroy ISIS, we're also trying to negotiate an arms deal with Iran because we don't want Iran to have the nuclear weapon. And this is one of the ironies, because it turns out that Saudi Arabia and Israel both are not only worried that Iran might get a nuclear weapon, but they're even more worried that if Iran gets sanctions lifted by promising not to build this nuclear weapon, it's going to be richer and it will help its Shiites more. And the Saudis are feeling very embattled.
You mentioned arms deals. Now, one of the interesting consequences of these tensions that are arising between the United States and their Persian Gulf allies is that France is perhaps looking for an opening to further engage in the region. And so there have been some reports that France is engaged in some arms deals, some very lucrative arms deals, and other support that's going to Saudi Arabia, looking for a way in which France can perhaps play the new major power in the region.
Well, it won't be the major power, but yes, $6 billion of arms, airplanes bought by Qatar from France. This is an important arms deal. Obviously, American arms makers are very jealous. They've dominated Gulf sales and Middle Eastern sales. The F-16 and all the other planes are tremendously effective. It is a shot across our bow saying, if you don't do what we want, we're not going to spend all our money in the United States. And that's, you know, one of those hard decisions. If you want the money, you got to do. Maybe we don't want that money all that much anymore. I mean, it's very costly to get sucked into Middle Eastern wars.
Well, shifts in the power balance, it seems to me, are coming, as you've suggested. Well, so last note in the Middle East today, the Vatican this week recognized officially the Palestinian state, urging others to support sovereignty for the Palestinian state. Of course, they're one of another 130 or so, about 130 states. Now, of course, the Vatican is not a state, but it is a sovereign entity. But 130 other states or so have recognized and supported a Palestinian state. But clearly, this is not what the Israelis want to see. Why does the Vatican get involved? What does this mean for the U.S. role in the area, as, you know, we too struggle with this two-state solution?
Right. Well, our relations with Israel are in flux, as are the world's. Prime Minister Netanyahu has won elections once again and formed a very right-wing government that has not even broached the topic of peace talks. It doesn't want a two-state solution. So America doesn't know how to stand towards this, because our policy is there should be two states and a state for the Palestinians. As you said, 130 countries already recognize the Palestinians as a state. So that Vatican recognize it is not unusual. The countries that don't recognize it are Europe and the United States. The rest of the world does. There's 193 countries in the world. Sweden has just recognized it, and several other countries, including Britain, have given these non-binding votes in their parliament. But it looks like Europe could be shifting, and that's of great concern to Israel. Israel made an announcement that this is not helpful to peace, that it's not – that it's going to spoil the Palestinians, and that they won't come to the table on the terms that Israel wants to see. But it's also partly the price that Netanyahu is going to pay if he doesn't want to have peace talks. And so we're – this is another tense moment about moving away from allies, as you said, Saudi Arabia, Israel, and more generally in the Middle East, trying to pivot towards Asia.
All right. Well, Joshua, thank you so much for that Middle East update. Always good to have you here.
So it's great to be here. Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this conversation and answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org or send us a tweet at WorldviewsKGOU, at Suzette Gorelot, and at Joshua_Landis. After a break, I'll talk with Kate Schechter, the CEO of the Oklahoma City-based non-governmental organization World Neighbors. I'm Suzette Gorelot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorelot. Today I'm joined by Kate Schechter. She's about to wrap up her first year as the president and CEO of the Oklahoma City-based nonprofit World Neighbors. For the past 65 years, the group has provided training and education to impoverished communities with a goal of finding solutions to hunger, poverty, and disease. Before taking over at World Neighbors last year, her 20-year career also included stops at the World Bank and an international nonprofit that focused on global health. Kate Schechter, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you.
Well, Kate, I want to get to your international work that you're doing today, but I really wanted to start with a personal question because you've had an interesting upbringing with your dad being a journalist for Time magazine. Not many kids get to grow up traveling the world with their dad as they're traveling to Moscow and Hong Kong and Tokyo. So tell us what that was like and how that ultimately did influence your future career.
Well, I was very privileged in retrospect to have had parents who thought that all the kids should go with them. And we lived overseas for the first 12 years of my life. We lived in Asia, in Hong Kong and Japan for 7 years. And then we lived in Moscow in a period when it was really the height of the Cold War. And my parents made a decision to send all five kids to Soviet public schools. And we're the first American children to go to Soviet school. And I learned Russian very quickly and have been lucky enough to be able to have kept it up since then. So all of that really had a strong influence on my worldview and on my desire to keep learning about different cultures around the world.
What an amazing experience having spent time in the Soviet Union as a child and continuing that experience throughout your adult career. But I have to ask you, I mean, Russia is obviously back in the news today, significant concerns about security and it's the threat that it perhaps poses, obviously, to Ukraine and others. But they also struggle significantly internally, and I think that's not well understood. They have a lot of health problems, development problems, economic issues that relate to employment and poverty in this country, and that feeds back into the health concerns. So what is it that we need to know about Russia as we get into this conversation about development that, will help us better grasp what is motivating them today or what it is that they need?
I fully agree with you. I think there is a lack of information about the extreme poverty throughout Russia and Ukraine and all of the former Soviet states. I mean, the Baltic states are doing much better, Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania. But in all the other ones that I've been to, you have extreme wealth and primarily extreme poverty. And yeah, that's just not covered very much. And there really isn't a lot of knowledge about the healthcare issues. Ukraine and Russia have some of the highest HIV rates in the world. The TB rate is very, very high. More people are dying from TB than any other disease in the former Soviet states. The healthcare infrastructure is still, I would say, collapsed and never really rebuilt. There was terrible isolation for the 75 years of the Soviet period in healthcare. The doctors that were working in the Soviet Union had no access to research that was going on outside, to new medications. They really were isolated. And that isolation has not really been overcome in the last 22 years since the walls went down. So you get out of Kiev or Moscow or St. Petersburg, but even within Moscow, St. Petersburg and Kiev, there are hospitals that you and I don't really want to go to. When I left AIHA, we had just been awarded a big program to help with blood safety throughout the former Soviet Union in Central Asia and Ukraine, which has this terrible problem of HIV and TB. And we were going – the blood safety program was to help with everything from blood donors all the way to blood transfusions, so from vein to vein, as they say in the blood world. And I was going into blood banks and going into hospitals and seeing the collapse of a system And this is 20 years after they've moved away from the Soviet system. So that, I think, is just one microcosm that was really revealing about how dangerous it is still, and how, you know, infectious diseases are still rampant there.
My guest is Kate Schechter, the CEO of World Neighbors, a nonprofit international aid organization that's headquartered in Oklahoma City. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. I'm Suzette Gorlot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. I'm talking with World Neighbors CEO Kate Schechter about her background and some of the work she's been doing leading the Oklahoma City-based nonprofit. When we left off, she told me about her work with blood safety in the former Soviet Union with the American International Health Alliance and how infectious diseases are still rampant in many parts of the world. Well, this relates to your current work that you're doing as CEO of World Neighbors, a non-governmental organization, development organization based in Oklahoma City. And so tell us a little bit about that and how, in particular, you know, you were referring to in some of your previous work these kind of partnership models and making sure that, you know, people on the ground are included in these development projects. How is it that World Neighbors engages in their local communities in order to promote development, healthcare, education, all of the things that we need to develop these societies?
Well, thanks for asking about that. I just started 4 months ago with World Neighbors. And actually, the countries that World Neighbors works in are very different than the countries that I have my primary experience in. I have worked in Asia, but other than that, all the countries that World Neighbors is working in now, 13 countries, are places that I've never actually been to. But I do have, as I've explained, a lot of program development experience, setting up programs and working with local governments and national governments. So the committee who, you know, interviewed me for the job understood that I was very straight with them. I said, I haven't been to these countries, but I think that a lot of my experience will work within the countries that World Neighbors is in. World Neighbors has been around since 1951. Dr. John Peters was a chaplain in the U.S. military. He was in the Philippines, and he was seeing all this terrible poverty. And when he came back, he was still haunted by what he had seen. And he became a minister, a Lutheran minister. And while he was speaking to his congregation one day, he told them, I still think about what happened and what I saw. And that led to him developing World Neighbors. I think it may be one of the oldest development organizations in the world. And he was really visionary in thinking about what will work, what will be sustainable, what will actually help people to improve their lives, and how can we help them to help themselves as opposed to handing them goods and equipment and money. So when I heard about World Neighbors, I was very, very attracted to the model, which is one in, you know, we hear it all the time, you know, teach a man to fish and he'll be able to help himself for the rest of his life. And that is essentially what the basis of the World Neighbors methodology is. World Neighbors works in very, very rural, out of the way, hard to get to places with really the poorest of the poor. So it's a different context than I've been working in these urban areas, in these terrible healthcare environments. But of course, the idea of people getting trained and learning new skills in order to help themselves is very similar to what I was doing when we were working with the healthcare partnerships. World Neighbors also is not a one-sector approach. We're not a healthcare development organization or an agriculture organization. What we do is work with communities to help them identify their priorities, to have them decide what they need to do first to lift themselves out of poverty. And then we help them with all the various components in a very holistic approach. What I just was privileged to go on my first trip for World Neighbors to Nepal and Indonesia. and to see a whole array of different programs that we've worked – people we've worked with for a decade to people we've worked with for a few months. And primarily people focus on agriculture. These are primarily subsistence farmers who need help in improving their livelihoods. And it's really incredible to see how it works. It's a proven methodology that has now been used in 45 countries. We've been able to help 26 million people around the world to change their lives.
So just as we conclude, give us an example of what you saw in Nepal and Indonesia as far as like those that you where you're just coming in versus those where you've been there for a long time and are finishing those projects, the distinctions. Can you give us just a picture of what that's like in the last minute or so that we have?
In Nepal, most of the men are now working outside of the country and sending in remittances. The country runs on remittances. So I only met women farmers. But what I did see is that with each new community that we go into, there is a more rapid pickup. So, for example, there are all these different innovative technologies that we're teaching them, organic composting, growing fodder grass for their livestock right in front of their homes. Gosh, there were all kinds of techniques that they were taught to improve their farming. But what maybe had resulted in somebody becoming really wealthy, actually, and being able to hire others, now you see in the new community that those technologies are happening faster because the experienced farmers are teaching the new farmers, and there's less of a lag time.
So fascinating, Kate. Thank you so much for being here today and sharing with us the important work that World Neighbors is doing. Many of us know the organization but don't understand exactly what they do. So it's great for you to share that with us today. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to my conversation with Kate Schechter, the president and CEO of World Neighbors. There's more information about this discussion and the Oklahoma City-based nonprofit on our website, kgou.org. While you're there, you can also find all of our past shows and a link to subscribe to our podcast. KGOU produces Worldviews alongside the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Brian Hardzinski produces the show, Symphony Swift handles our research, and our intern, Sam Dupre, will continue working on digital content through the summer. For Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Gorlott.